Second subject is moksha ritual. Always nice to reflect on moksha during this ritual. And Gurudeva has given us a beautiful definition of moksha. Moksha occurs after karma has been resolved and realization of Parashiva has been attained. Nowhere else do you find such a clear definition of moksha. So, as we know, it's a twofold process, and that's one of the reasons we've been talking a lot about karma and resolving karma during this ritual, as it fits right in to the definition of moksha. And of course, we've also been talking about realization of Parashiva. So we had a wonderful group of spiritual seekers, we'll say, were here this last phase. And I gave them a talk on enlightenment that you've heard me give at least once here. And the idea of the talk focuses on, number one, that Hinduism doesn't just believe in things, it wants you to experience things. So in some religious traditions, the sum total effort is to get you to believe in God. You know, you don't believe in God, well, you should believe in God. And they try and reason you into believing in God in different ways. And finally you say, okay, I believe in God. And they say, great, okay, we're done. Process is done here. This person believes in God. We've achieved the end of our religious goals. But of course, in Hinduism, belief in God is only the first step. We want to move beyond belief into experience of God. So the experience of God is what we are focusing on, and I told this Swami Vivekananda story. I won't tell it to you again. You know it. When he met the Ramakrishna and so forth, and found out that Ramakrishna had experienced God, and that was good enough for him. He was the only person that Vivekananda met who said he had experienced God. And so that's what he was looking for in his teacher. So one of the problems about the thoughts about experiencing God are we are dealing with some fairy tale concepts regarding enlightenment and the experience of God, which is that here we are today, we're experiencing God, 0% of God. We have no clue, you know, nothing. We don't have any consciousness of God. And somehow, lightning is going to strike, and we're going to become 100% conscious of God. That's the false concept regarding enlightenment. And it just happens like that instantly. We're transformed from having no consciousness at all to having 100% consciousness of God in one instant. So, of course, it doesn't work like that. And we start in very simple ways. And the simplest way to see God, of course, is to see God through a holy man. That's one of the reasons we like to be in the presence of someone like Gurudeva, is we're experiencing God, and we're uplifted because of it. We look at Gurudeva and we see God emanating from him. So, of course, that's the easiest way to see God, is in a saintly person. Then Gurudeva has given us a second method, which is we can look deeply into anyone's eyes, the eyes of any person. Just look deeply enough and we'll see God. Because God is the life of life. Uyir kuyir. God is the life of life. So, of course, as we know, we have to set aside the fact we may not like the person, or we're mad at them for this, or their personality that, or their intellect this, the emotions that. We have to look deeply enough into the person to see God. It's there. We just have to do that. And Gurudeva often quotes Yoga Swami's statement in that regard, is God Shiva is all powerful, you know, but there's only one thing that God Shiva can't do. Remember that? He can't separate himself from you. He's inside of you. He's inside of everyone. He can't take himself out. The whole system is built on his presence there. No form would exist if God Shiva wasn't inside of it all. So God Shiva is in there, inside, and we just look deeply enough into the eyes of someone and we can see God. And the next way of seeing God is through external worship, as we did this morning. We all know all about external worship, and because of the invocations involved in temple worship, divine beings come and we feel their presence. We're uplifted by it. Particularly on auspicious days such as festival days, the presence is very strong. And that's, of course, a third way of finding God, which is even more of a profound experience, more of the presence of God. And fourth way, of course, is inside of us, in meditation. Once the subconscious mind is pure enough, or in the case of children, it's pure already, just gets clouded as you grow up. When the subconscious mind is pure enough, we can look inside and see spiritual light. We can go into that and go deeper and deeper into God within us. We're experiencing our soul nature. And of course, this is encouraged, particularly during Moksha Ratau, our internalized worship. So there's a beautiful statement that starts Dancing with Shiva, and it, being the first statement, sets the tone for the whole tradition. Remember the question it asks? Who am I? Right? Not talking about God as separate from you, which you might find in another tradition. The greatness of God, this and that, something, you know. It's talking about who am I? It's asking a question. Who am I? And Yogaswami's first Natchindanai starts off the same way. He made me to know myself. He made me to know I. So it's right in the tradition. Who am I? So the answer, Rishis proclaim that we are not our body, mind, or emotions. We are divine souls on a wondrous journey. We came from God, live in God, and are evolving into oneness with God. We are, in truth, the truth we seek. So that's a beautiful statement. We came from God, live in God, and are evolving into oneness with God. So that's, of course, the consciousness we all want to strive for. So evolving into gives that sense that it's a gradual process. It doesn't happen overnight. So in answer to the question, who am I? Of course, if you're not on the spiritual path, you're a human being, right? Well, I'm a human being. I've got a physical body, I've got emotions, I've got an intellect. That's who I am. I've got an ego, smarter than some, not as smart as others. Today I'm sad. Later today I'll be hungry. No, that's who I am. Right? Just a human being. So, of course, merging with Shiva, the goal of merging with Shiva is to take us beyond that identity of a human being into our soul nature. So the first identity we have as a spiritual being is as an individual soul. What's the difference between feeling like an individual soul and feeling like a human being? An individual soul, you feel spiritual, you feel perfect. It doesn't mean everything you've done has always been wise or right. It doesn't mean you're smarter than everybody. It just means you feel complete, you feel pure. You feel, I'm all right right now. You feel like you're on a spiritual journey. You don't feel bad about yourself. You don't regret what you've done in the past, because that's not your soul nature. That's just your subconscious mind. And if that's present, then you're identifying with your humanness. That needs to be gone. So part of merging with Shiva is getting rid of negative identifications about us as a human being, what we did, how bad we are, how limited we are, so we can identify with our soul nature as a spiritual being who is content and moving forward toward oneness with God. So we take that one step deeper, and Yogaswami's famous statement applies. Bliss, 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 here, there, everywhere am I. So, of course, the key word is I, right? It doesn't say bliss, 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 everywhere is God. No, it says bliss, 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 everywhere am I. Oh, he's talking about, he's answering the question, who am I, right? But he's answering it at a deeper level than I'm a spiritual being who's evolving toward oneness with God. He's saying he's omnipresent. He's all-pervasive consciousness, that he is Satchit Ananda. He's gone into a deeper sense of I. He's gone into the soul, what we call the essence of the soul, the core of the soul nature, to the consciousness that's all-pervasive. And it's always there. We don't have to create it by something we do. The soul body is maturing. It's like the tree, you know. You plant a seed, it grows into a mature tree. It takes time. So the soul body is maturing. It's changing. It's going through a certain process of becoming something more than it is. But Satchit Ananda is always there. It doesn't change. You just have to find it. You just have to go deeply enough into yourself to find that part of you. It's all-pervasive consciousness. So Yogaswami did that. Bliss, bliss, bliss. Here, there, everywhere, am I. So this, of course, is evolving further into oneness with God. And then, as we know, there's one more, last but not least, one more spiritual identity of Parashiva, or the transcendent, which again isn't a case of changing or becoming. It's always there, available to be claimed any time of day or night. There's nothing we have to do to earn it, realize it, become it. Could come at any time because it's totally outside of the realm of time and space. It doesn't become. It's just a question of finding it, claiming that part of our identity. So the first obstacle to realizing Parshiva is to feel, we have to do this, this, and this, and this before we can realize it. I'm confident. I'm not ready. Maybe 20 more years of meditation. I should be good enough in meditation to realize it. So we put it off for 20 years. We feel, well, I did this when I was young, therefore I don't deserve to be Parashiva. Maybe next lifetime. Put it off because of that. So, to get rid of the first obstacle, we need to feel, gee, maybe this very minute I'll realize Parashiva. There's no, we have to give up the idea of putting the experience off, that now isn't the moment when we can claim to be Parashiva. Because it has nothing to do with what we do. Because it transcends time and space. Time and space goes along. And Parashiva just transcends it all. It doesn't relate. So what we do doesn't affect being Parashiva. So Gurudeva describes Parashiva very nicely in a number of places, and the one we were talking about on a recent Sun 5 is a non-experience. It's a beautiful statement which helps us understand Parashiva, and that normally we have what's experienced and the experiencer. We have awareness and consciousness. Awareness is like the physical eye, and consciousness is like what we see. So the eye can see many different things, but it's still the eye. So our awareness can experience many different states of consciousness, but it's a pure awareness. It doesn't change. So just like if we close our eyes, we don't have eyes, we can't see anything, right? So if we take away awareness, we don't experience consciousness. So the absence of awareness is what Gridiva refers to as a non-experience. You've taken away the experiencer, so there's nothing, no possible experience, so it's a non-experience. When awareness is present, everything is an experience. But when you take it away, it's the only non-experience. So if there's no experiencer there, how do you know what's there? If you can't experience Parashiva, how do you know you experience Parashiva? Does that make any sense? It's kind of a dilemma. If an experiencer, awareness is required to have an experience, and the experiencer isn't there, how do you know when it wasn't there you experienced Parashiva? So, by the aftermath, by the reaction. So, how it influences your consciousness, the state of consciousness you are in before the realization of Parashiva, and the state of consciousness you're in after the realization of Parashiva, if you compare the two, you'll see a difference. There's a change, a subtle change. And being able to identify that change is how you know you experienced Parashiva. So, qualities of that change are your concept of time and space is different because you stepped out of time and space. It's like if you leave Earth's orbit in a spaceship and you come back, Earth is going to look different, right? You're going to get a different overview of Earth than you had when you were on Earth before you took off in the spaceship. You're going to have kind of a grand overview. The world is going to look different. You're going to see it from a different perspective. So time and space is the same way that normally we think of time and space in a linear sense. Everything's going along step by step by step. There's past, there's present, and there's future. But when you come out of Parashiva, you don't look at it that way. That the past, the present, and the future are all existing in the present. And the example we used, I'll repeat it since it seemed to be a good example, on Sun 5 was the idea of the stars. We look up into the sky, we're seeing the stars, right? We think it's the present. But we're seeing light that's been traveling for a long, long time, right? So we're actually looking into the past. We look over there, and if it's closer, we're looking a couple of million years into the past. We look over there, if it's further away, we're looking many, many millions of years into the past. We're seeing something that was millions of years ago by looking up into the sky. Over here, 1 million, over there, 10 million, over there, maybe 100 million. So we're looking into the past by looking up into the sky. So similarly, the inner worlds and the outer worlds relate. And the guideline that devas gave us regarding prayers, you may remember this, is you send a prayer to the devas and they act immediately. But that action takes 72 hours to manifest in our world. Remember that? We've read that a few times. So what are they saying? They're doing something, and it shows up here 72 hours later. It's like the sky. Something happens in the sky, and it shows up here X number of years later. But if it happened there now, and it happens here in the future, isn't the future in the now? It's just showing up here in a linear sense. So it shows the future exists in the present. The simple example of the prayers. The other example is the class advice given in the Saivai Chaucers. It says, if you're teaching a class and you want to teach it in a mystical way, don't have a class more often than every 72 hours. Remember that? It's the same principle. And they say, the students and the teacher meet in the inner planes and have the class. And then 3 days later, they meet in the outer planes and the class occurs. So, of course, we're wiser in the inner planes than we are in the outer planes. So, therefore, more wisdom is present in the class because we already had the class 72 hours ago, and this is just the outer reflection of the class. So that's a very interesting principle. So we begin to think about time differently. That the future exists in the present, somewhere. Likewise, the past exists in the present, because there is only the present. But what manifests in the first world, different parts of the past and the future at different times. So when we start to look at time and space in a different form, different ways, perhaps we're coming out of a Parashiva experience. And the idea being, again, it's the state of mind you're in before the experience versus the state of mind you're in right afterwards. If you compare those two states of mind, it has to be right before and right after. There needs to be a change in order to be sure you had the experience of Parashiva. You can't compare the state of mind an hour before and an hour afterwards. It might be the same state of mind, you know. But right before and right after, you compare them, and that's how you can reflect upon having stepped outside of time and space into the experience of Parashiva. The other example that I gave during that class was the throwing the rock into the pond. If you have a pond of water and you have one person with his back to the pond and the other person is going to throw a rock or not throw a rock. So when he says, okay, turn around and you look at the pond. So how do you know if he threw the rock or not? If you see ripples, right? You can see ripples where the rock went into the water if he threw the rock. If he didn't throw the rock, you can't see any ripples. So you didn't see what happened, but you can tell what happened by the aftermath, by the reaction of the rock going into the water on the water. You can tell if he threw the rock or not without actually seeing the experience. So that's like Parashiva. The water is the mind. So you can tell the reaction on the mind of realizing Parashiva by how the mind is moving after the experience. If it's the same as before the experience, you know, the rock wasn't thrown, Parashiva wasn't realized. But if there's different movement in the mind afterwards, then Parashiva was realized. Or the aftermath of the non-experience is how we judge that it occurred. So as a closing thought, Moksha Ratau, it's a wonderful time to make progress on internal worship. So the idea of progress on internal worship is to just go a little deeper than we are now. It's not like we're trying to go all the way from here around the world four times or something. You know, we're just trying to move forward, not stay in the same place. Be able to go deeper within ourselves, into our spiritual nature, into our soul nature. Or if we go inside and we hit problems, to get rid of those problems. Nothing unusual about going inside and hitting problems, but we do need to clean them out. We need to do some inner ashram sadhana, do some house cleaning through Mahavasanada Tantra, through penance, through whatever. We need to get rid of whatever's in there that's bothering us. That's also moksha ratao, is being aware of what's inside of us. And if there's negative areas, getting rid of them, because there's no reason to harbor them. Where these teachings are, we can clear out anything negative in the mind because it's not us, right? We're the soul nature. It's just the external being has acquired these negative qualities. So just the fact that it acquired them gives us the confidence we can get rid of them, right? They weren't there in the beginning. We weren't born with them. Just some experiences we had put things on our mind. So we can get rid of them through the tools that Gurudev has given us. Om Namah Shivaya. Have a wonderful day.